It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. The vast popularity of zombie films and zombie lore has taken on a life of its own, especially in Pittsburgh, a.k.a. Zombieburg. And fans of the undead come from all walks of life, including some of our most astute scientific researchers. For Timothy Versteinen, assistant professor in psychology at CMU and the Center for the Neural Basis of Cognition, zombies are a fascination and a teaching tool. He and collaborator Bradley Wojtek teach brain-behavior relationships using models of zombie brains. Here to tell us more about it is Timothy Versteinen, assistant professor in psychology at CMU. Welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So how can the brain of a zombie, something that doesn't actually exist, possibly be of use to neuroscientists?
It does sound strange, right?
Yes.
You know, we're trying to diagnose something that doesn't exist. But zombies turn out to be a very useful tool in a lot of ways because they exhibit a lot of very strange behaviors. And you can link up a lot of those behaviors to different parts of the brain. So what Brad and I are trying to do is kind of teach classic neurology. Way back in the day before we had MRIs or brain scans, if you were a neurologist and you had somebody who came in and he got a lump on his head or a bullet to the back of the head and he still survived and started acting strange, you couldn't really look into his brain and see what was broken. So you had to observe his behaviors very carefully. You had to characterize exactly what was wrong and what wasn't wrong. And through this careful investigation of this patient's behavior, you could come up with a guess or a hypothesis as to what was wrong with his brain, taking into account what you knew from previous patients who, you know, had been studied in the literature before. So Brad and I are kind of teaching that method of characterizing behavior, looking at things very carefully, and then trying to link it back up to the brain. So we look at how zombies move, how they may or may not remember things, how they may or may not recognize people, and go back and link that back up to what we know from both, you know, brain imaging studies in humans and classic neurological literature.
And of course, you know, there's an aspect of stagecraft in this for you. You are essentially fooling people into, you know, wanting to read and learn more about the brain, aren't
right,
you?
Right, right. That's our whole goal, is to trick people into learning something real about neuroscience. But don't tell anybody, because
okay.
That's a secret.
Yeah,
okay.
It stays between us.
All right, great, great, yeah. No, Brad and I have always been interested in science outreach as leveraging popular culture to get people interested in what we find very interesting. And, you know, the brain is a very fascinating organ in and of itself, and people find neuroscience inherently interesting, but it doesn't have, you know, the same pull as, say, zombies, right? So what we're trying to do is really leverage that popularity and excitement that people get about things like zombies and focus their attention in towards neuroscience and get them to learn a little bit more about the brain than they probably would have otherwise.
But why use this angle, you know, when trying to research and teach the brain? I mean, isn't the human brain interesting enough as it is without bringing this into it?
It is, but let's face it, you didn't bring me in to talk about my research on the influence of obesity on neural structure or sensory motor plasticity. You brought me in to talk about zombies. So zombies have this inherent pull that makes them broadly popular, broadly interesting. But you are right. Neuroscience is a very popular topic right now. The problem is I think there's a lot of misnomers or misinformation that are known popularly about the brain that aren't true. So, for example, the belief that people are inherently left brain or right brain. That's a very popular myth.
See, we hear that all the time. You're saying that's not true?
That is absolutely not true.
Man, we have to stop and process that one. You know, you're always hearing about people being left brain or right brain.
Right, right. But that's just a myth that's been kind of carried over. It's not really a myth. It's a miscategorization of some of the early literature on lateralization in the brain. And it just kind of carries through in popular culture. And so Brad and I are trying to kind of fight fire with fire. So get people interested again in these kind of topics of neuroscience, but teach real neuroscientific principles. So I think people are interested in the brain. It's just they're kind of interested at this very superficial level. And what we're trying to do is get people to think a little bit deeper than they normally would.
So okay, let's extend this farther into mythology or horror movie mythology and look at Frankenstein, where the brain becomes a big part of that story, and that some brains are, you know, are partially evil and right. some are partially good and some more good than evil than others
right.
are.
Right.
Any of that is any of that true, or can you use any of that to advance your?
No, that borders on kind of phrenology in some ways. You know, back in the day in the 1800s, there was a whole group of people that would kind of look at the lumps and structures of your skull and say that because you had a bump on this side of your head, you were more or less likely to be a criminal, or you had a bump over here that meant you were slightly more moral than anybody else.
Aren't you glad you're not living? We're living in the 21st century as opposed to the 1800s.
You know, I say that, but I have to say that my field also does make those same claims, except we just say about brain volume or brain thickness. And we start to make these same brain behavior relationships that are quasi-phrenology. We just need to be a little bit more sophisticated in how we ask our questions. But
so maybe Mary Shelley wasn't so far off after all.
No, Mary Shelley's idea I thought was fantastic, both from a philosophical sense and from a purely scientific sense. When do you reanimate tissue? And what's the consequence of reanimating tissue that was dead? Frankenstein could have been abnormal because the brain was just starved with oxygen and nutrients for so long that, he had a lot of brain damage. And so what was resurrected could have just been an extensively brain damaged individual. And that, that's going to lead to a lot of abnormal behaviors.
We're talking with Timothy Versteinen. He's assistant professor in psychology at CMU and the Center for Neural Basis of Cognition. And he is talking about zombies as a teaching tool. I understand, Timothy, that you have different models representing different zombie brains. What can you tell us about this?
Well, so the model is kind of tongue-in-cheek. What we did was we characterized first the kind of behaviors that zombies do, how they move, how they pay attention to things.
Now, which zombies are we because as you know, there are different kinds.
There are multiple kinds. We even have a hypothesis for why there are multiple kinds. But we'll start with the Romero slow zombies,
okay.
The kind of original right. George Romero type zombies.
Sure.
Once you characterize their behaviors, what we did is we took an image of a real normal human's brains and we used a computer algorithm to kind of fake lesion areas of the brain that were linked to motor control or the particular type of motor control that their deficits are in, their visual processing, their visual attention, and come up with a glimpse of what the structure of a zombie brain would look like. And then we give talks where we kind of point to these different areas that have been lesioned and say, well, this might explain why zombies can't pay attention to things for more than a very short period of time. Or this lesion down here might explain why zombies lumber the way they do rather than shuffle walk.
And people can take this and transfer it to an actual human being and say, this, if there's something affecting this part of the brain, this might lead to a person's motor skills or physical ability to move around, this might affect that in some way.
In a very general sense, yeah. So, for example, in the talk, we differentiate the idea of the movement, the way that zombies kind of walk, as not being like what people see in Parkinson's disease, which is the most well-known motor disease out there. It turns out that zombies don't move the same way that patients with Parkinson's disease do. The types of movements that you see, the big lumbering stance, the kind of awkward walk, the look that looks like they're kind of having balance problems, it's all similar to what you see in patients who suffer from a rare disorder called spinal cerebellar ataxia, which is a degeneration of an area in the brain called the cerebellum. And so what we do is we can teach people that there's these two different motor disease and they have very different behavioral symptoms, one linked up to the basal ganglia, which is Parkinson's, and the other linked up to spinal cerebellar ataxia, which is cerebellum. So in a lot of ways, we can point to this model of the brain and say, this area controls motor control. But even then, we're trying to get a more nuanced take on these understandings of brain behavior relationships. In a very general sense, we're trying to get people to kind of understand which area of the brains control what functions. But we're also trying to teach how to make inferences about these brain behavior relationships in a nuanced way.
And you say that even in the slow zombie brain, a significant amount of brain matter remains.
Right, right. So zombies can still see, they can still hear, they can still smell. So in our...
Do zombies, can they exhibit ethical behavior? And I ask this because there's a famous old zombie movie that came out some 40 years or so before George Romero's film called White Zombie, starring Bela Lugosi. And in that film, one of the zombies is trying to dissuade the doctor from doing harm to another.
Right.
Can they, is it possible with what's left over to Well, we're really getting hypothetical.
Right. I mean, this is way out of left field. My first take is, can we explain why humans are not ethical? And that's very,
yes,
from a neurological standpoint, that's very far.
That do exist.
Yeah. Yeah. The other thing is that the zombies, from what I understand from the, you know, silent era, 1920s, 1930s, that was actually more linked up to the concept of a zombie in Haitian voodoo culture.
Correct.
Right. Which are actually, in a lot of ways, very different than the kind of horror movie zombies. The namesakes are kind of shared, but if you actually look at the very real phenomenon of Haitian zombies, while they have a really strong link to neuroscience, they're a very different cultural phenomenon. They're actually real people. They've just been tricked into thinking that they died and were resurrected, and they're held as slaves. So you can really think about them as being true people, because in reality they are. Whereas the horror movie zombies are kind of, They're just, you know, fake creatures that we can play with as we see fit for our educational purposes.
And, of course, White Zombie was just a horror movie as well.
Right,
you're making
right.
a very important distinction here, Doctor. And I'm curious how the University of Cal Berkeley prepared you for all of this.
Oh. Cal really did just allow me to kind of go off on tangents on my own. So Brad and I were graduate students back at Berkeley together. And we shared a common passion for both neuroscience and horror movies. We're both diehard geeks. Brad's been going to Comic-Con, the big comic convention in California, for 15 years or so. So we shared this passion for both brains and zombies. So we eventually just kind of learned to meld the two together. And at one point about 3 years ago, Brad was asked to give a talk on the zombie brain. And it was, you know, for both of us, that was the most perfect convergence of our two passions that there could be. So we decided to kind of take on this task of figuring out what a zombie brain would look like. And everything's kind of spiraled out of control from that.
And we were talking earlier about the different models that you have representing different zombie brains.
Mm-hmm.
How did you come up with a model? Like, what did you base that on?
Well, you can use the word model very loosely here.
Okay.
It's we basically took a normal image of a human brain and kind of atrophied away certain areas to make it look what a zombie brain would look like. But it's not a model in the sense that, you know, we can use it to make predictions of what a zombie would do in context A or context B. It's just a pretty picture of a brain that has particular lesions that we can link to behavior. But again, all we did was take a look at their behavior. How do they walk? How do they look? How do they, you know, attend to things? And kind of sculpted away the brain to make it look like what it should look like.
We're talking with Timothy Versteinen, assistant professor in psychology at CMU, about his use of zombies and zombie brains as a teaching tool. Somebody tuning in might really be wondering, what on earth are they talking about? Well, this is what we're discussing, and you can take part in the discussion. I do want to open this up. I'm guessing some people might have questions. We have a few minutes left. 412-246-2002, the number to call again. 412-246-2002 is the number if you'd like to call and have a comment or question for our guest, Timothy Versteinen. Now, based on what you have found out, what should people know in the case of a zombie attack?
Oh, yeah. So a couple years ago, we actually released an infographic on Wired Magazine about the scientific principles of surviving the zombie apocalypse. And again, this is all just tongue-in-cheek, but the idea is
but
that—
But you never know.
You never know, right. We can always, you know, knowledge is always a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, part of the model of the zombie brain is that they have a very short memory span due to a lesion of the brain called the hippocampus. So they can't remember things for more than a short period of time. So one survival skill is to hide out and just try to be as quiet as possible until the zombie forgets that you're there and can walk away. Another kind of survival attack or tactic is using attention-grabbing things to grab the zombie's attention, because they have a very strange phenomenon known as disengagement deficit, where their kind of attention is locked in to whatever is the most salient stimulus they see. Anybody who's seen the movie Land of the Dead, which is one of Romero's more recent movies, knows that the humans were using fireworks to kind of distract zombies, and they would always just stare at fireworks for as long as they were kind of happening. And that kind of inability to control your attention is called disengagement deficit. So one of our survival strategies was use, you know, firecrackers and flash bombs to just, you know, distract the zombies. And if you could do that, you can kind of quietly sneak away off the side, because they're always going to be paying attention to the most salient thing there.
Very interesting. Now, and so if you're nice to a zombie, I mean, don't even try to be nice because they're going to forget it.
No.
You know, you can remove the thorn from the lion's paw, but unlike the lion, they are not
right.
That's
right.
Not going to stick.
Right. You can remove the thorn from the zombie's hand, but it'll still eat your brain.
So I'm curious as to what the reaction has been from the academic community to all this. You know, does anybody wander by your office, Timothy, and say, you know, honestly, what are you doing with all your time, sir?
You know, I ask myself that same question every day. There has been a mixed opinion in the academic community. I will have to say that Carnegie Mellon and the University of Pittsburgh have been surprisingly supportive of this endeavor. We've been encouraged to give these talks. There's a book in the works that we're trying to do to kind of lay out this formal model of the zombie brain. And they've been very supportive. A few people are a little bit concerned that it's going to dominate over our real science. I mean, this is really our night job. We don't really get paid that much for doing this. We're just doing this for fun and to be good educators. But by and large, the response we've gotten from our colleagues has been very positive.
Is this a part of what we're going to see more and more of to get people interested in STEM, in research and science and math, that you're going to have to come up with some kind of shtick, and in this case, you've come up with a zombie shtick.
Right. Well, I mean, anything we can do to get more attention to STEM, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, I think is what the acronym stands for. Anything we can get people more engaged in those kind of topics, the better. You know, we live in a country where, you know, 34% of the populace doesn't believe in the mechanics of evolution. Half of the United States doesn't believe in the link between human carbon emissions and global climate change. And these are all things that have been validated scientifically. So if you're a consumer of scientific literature, you're following that and you would believe in those kind of mechanics. So we really need to figure out as scientists better ways to engage the larger populace. And getting things where people are inherently interested in and kind of using that to refocus their attention is going to be very useful for getting people reinterested in the science and kind of engineering and mathematics fields.
And you mentioned the book. What are the other potential uses for your research?
Really, it's a strictly educational tool. So I would be very careful at not calling it research. Any grant administrator out there, this isn't my real research. But there have been people who have taken these and made lesson plans to go to high schools and middle schools to teach neuroscience. And there's a fellow out in New Mexico who went around to different middle schools and high schools and had real slices of brains. But he would use the kind of zombie model to get the students interested, and then he would bring out the real slices of brains and they could play with them and get interested in what the parietal lobe looks like or what the, you know, cerebellum looks like by actually physically holding a brain.
And what's the what kind of reaction do they get?
Oh, he said it was very popular. Students really, I mean, once you see a physical brain, if you're not inherently disgusted by it, you find it fascinating. And the students really got engaged by it.
Well, it's all very interesting. And Timothy Versteinen is an assistant professor in psychology at CMU in the Center for the Neural Basis of Cognition, talking about using zombies and his fascination with zombies as a teaching tool. Sounds like it's going rather well. Timothy Versteinen, thank you so much for being with us and talking with us on Essential Pittsburgh today.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up, well, you've heard of Night of the Living Dead, the movie. We'll tell you about Night of the Living Dead, the opera. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA.